طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. On May 4th of this year, an important event took place at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. It was a forum called Not Backing Down and dealt with a constant assault by pro-Israeli organizations to shut down pro-Palestinian voices. Ironically, which in fact made the point, there were serious attempts to prohibit the forum from taking place by the Zionist lobby, including an unsuccessful lawsuit which emphasized the need for this forum to challenge this systematic campaign to silence the Palestinian narrative. This morning we feature voices from the UMass Forum. You will hear conference organizer Professor Sut Jolly, Angela Davis, moderator Vijay Prashad, and Nation columnist Dave Zirin. Next week, we will feature the other speakers, Linda Sarsour, Roger Waters, and Mark Lamont Hill. We begin with Professor Sut Jolly introducing the forum.
Good evening, everyone. I am Sut Jolly, Professor of Communication at UMass. And Executive Director of the Media Education Foundation, the organizer of this event. The specific genesis for the event tonight came from the firing of one of our panelists, Mark Lamont Hill, from CNN for his comments at the United Nations about the denial of human rights of the Palestinian people. I reached out to him about coming here to discuss the case, and very quickly events began to overtake us. First, an award to Angela Davis by the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute was rescinded because of a support for the Palestinian people. And then, of course, as you've just seen, there was the firestorm of abuse and death threats rained upon Representative Ilhan Omar for daring to accurately describe the reality of AIPAC's influence on American politics, something that AIPAC itself proudly boasts about in its promotional materials. So I started to reach out to the other people on our distinguished panel. I did have hopes of one other person to join us, the famed Palestinian legislator Hanan Ashrawi, who, after visiting the United States for decades, was suddenly unable to obtain a visa from the Trump administration. I hope you will ask why her important voice as an elected representative of the Palestinian people has been silenced from the discussion we will have tonight. Indeed, why was Omar Barghouti, the co-founder of the BDS movement, also denied a visa to speak in the U.S.? Similarly, there have been attempts to silence the voices of our panel and this event. As one journalist described it in a headline, Israel supporters try to shut down UMass Forum about efforts by Israel supporters to shut down debate. The irony is just like you don't even have to comment on it. I have been told that scores of calls have come into the university administration protesting tonight's gathering. The State Republican Jewish Committee and the State Republican Party have called on the university to cancel the event. A letter to the chancellor signed by 80 right-wing pro-Israel organizations, including the Zionist Organization of America, the American Jewish Council, and the World Jewish Council, protested the event and wanted the university to disassociate itself from it, demanding that the three departments who originally co-sponsored, the Departments of Communication, of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, and the Resistance Studies Initiative, demanding that they withdraw their sponsorship. The university, specifically the Chancellor, held firm to the principles of academic freedom and said that departments had the right to sponsor events on the most important issues of the day. That, in the words of Chancellor Subbaswamy, quote, promoting the free exchange of ideas is one of the most important functions of the university. Further, as an act of solidarity against this intimidation by these reactionary outside groups, actually and some internal ones as well, and in defense of academic freedom and free speech, a number of other departments have subsequently joined the list of sponsors. The departments of Anthropology, Sociology, Philosophy, Health Promotion and Policy, and STEPEC, the Social Thought and Political Economy Program, have all come on board, and I am very grateful for their support. I know that there was also very vigorous debate and discussion in a number of other departments about whether to support the event. In fact, I think it's safe to say that very few events in recent UMass history had garnered as much attention and argument as this one. So the event actually has already served its primary function, to stimulate talk, about the way in which discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is severely curtailed. Finally, if all that wasn't enough, there was also a lawsuit filed by a lawyer who's affiliated with another right-wing organization, Americans for Peace and Tolerance, a group of Islamophobic reactionaries. I love the names, right? to force the university to cancel this event. The injunction, of course, was thrown out, laughed out of court, actually, on Thursday. As everyone knew that it would be, even the people bringing it knew it would be thrown out of court. Yes, yes. That allowed this event to proceed. But if the injunction was not really about stopping this event, why did they spend the thousands of dollars on it? And the answer is pretty clear. It was not about this event. It was about the next one that may be planned by some other group. It was an act of intimidation and bullying about the future. I want to close by thanking everyone at UMass and throughout the Valley who's reached out to me and my colleagues at the Media Education Foundation over the past couple of weeks to express their support for this event. I also want to say a special thank you to members of Students for Justice in Palestine at UMass, for helping to promote this event under very difficult circumstances. I'm also very grateful to the members of Jewish Voice for Peace, Western Mass, especially Rachel Weber of JVP, who went to court for us and helped defeat the motion to stop this event by making an impassioned argument about the dangers of watering down the dangers of actual anti-Semitism by conflating it with criticism of Israeli repression. I also want to acknowledge the staff of the Fine Arts Center. They have been fantastic, as has the entire team working behind the scenes to pull this event off. Finally, I want to thank the entire staff of the Media Education Foundation for all their work on this event, especially David Mello for his technical support, and especially Loretta Alper and Jeremy Earp, who have put countless hours into managing the details of this event. Our main work at the Media Education Foundation actually isn't putting on events, although you would never know it from tonight. It's actually making movies. And a couple of years ago, we made a movie about the kinds of efforts we've seen over the past few weeks to silence pro-Palestinian voices and shape and distort how Americans understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's called The Occupation of the American Mind. And he lays out the different ways and different forces and interests that have worked to shut down debate, silence dissent, confuse the issues, and conceal the reality of what Palestinian life is like living under Israeli military occupation. But even more importantly than that, our film shows that things are shifting as more and more people, especially young Palestinians and Jews who are joining in coalition with allies in the Black Liberation Struggle to demand justice, are starting to see through these intimidation tactics and refusing to back down. What the resulting desperation, the phone calls, the letters, the lawsuits reveal to me is that the right are scared. They are petrified of these positive changes taking place in the culture. In that spirit of renewed hope, before we bring out our moderator and our panelists, I want to share a short clip from the conclusion of The Occupation of the American Mind, narrated by Roger Waters, that speaks to this historic moment.
Over just the past few years, the proliferation of social media and internet news sources has made it increasingly difficult for the Israeli government and pro-Israel groups in the U.S. to manage American perceptions of the conflict. Video footage and reporting from the ground bearing witness to the reality of the occupation are now more accessible than ever on the internet. In addition, over the past few years, a number of high-profile documentaries made by Israeli and Palestinian filmmakers alike have trained a harsh light on current Israeli policy and the repression of Palestinian rights. While activists from the Black Lives Matter movement have been making explicit connections between police violence against African Americans and the Israeli military's repression of Palestinians,
we stand next to people who continue to courageously struggle and resist the occupation. People who continue to dream and fight for freedom. From Ferguson to Palestine, the struggle for freedom continues.
And all of these developments seem to be having an effect. Polls now show that while sympathy for Israel remains at all-time highs among older Americans, it has been hemorrhaging among young people.
Despite the efforts of the lobby, something really striking is taking place. Lots of young people are abandoning the mainstream media and turning instead to other independent sources. So they have a totally different way of making sense of what's happening, an unfiltered view of Israel's repression. And pro-Israel operatives like Frank Luntz are in a panic. In his latest report, he calls what's happening with young people a disaster and demands that Israel supporters respond. And people have answered the call. You have powerful right-wing billionaires like Sheldon Adelson, a major donor to Republican candidates, bankrolling a campaign to silence and intimidate student activists on college campuses. But it's not working. Groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, who see what's happening to Palestinians as a civil rights issue, have refused to be intimidated. They're refusing to back down, even though they're being labeled as anti-Semitic and terrorist sympathizers. And their numbers are growing.
As the discourse begins to open, more people are starting to understand this as a rights-based issue, not an issue of radicalism. This is a movement for the rights of people whose rights are being denied, who are living under occupation, who want to live in their country freely, just like anybody else.
You can see just so many video clips of kids having their hands smashed by soldiers with batons. You can see just so many pictures of thousands of people being killed, as happened in Gaza. And at a certain point, there's a cognitive dissonance. You realize that what you're being told is a pack of lies.
Let's just get away from the mythologies and talk about the realities, and then maybe be able to persuade people that they should not any longer give their unwavering support to a nation engaged in a policy that's not just inhumane and brutal, but ultimately suicidal.
Given the central role that the United States plays in backing Israel, it seems to me Americans, all Americans, have a right to question particular Israeli policies, and in particular, the prolonged occupation, the fact that the Palestinian people have been kept without a state and without any political rights for decades now.
For us in the United States, I think, the issue has to be, what is our government doing? How is our government allowing, enabling, supporting, arming, defending Israeli violations?
In the end, this comes down to a battle for the minds of the American people. A battle over the stories they're told to make sense of this conflict. A battle over perception. The more Americans are able to see the reality of occupation with their own eyes, to see images of routine daily violence, of the repression and humiliation that never make their way into mainstream news, the more they'll question the image of Israel as this tiny little David up against the bullying Arab Goliath, and start to wonder if it's actually the outgunned Palestinians who might be the real Davids here. When that starts becoming the dominant perception here in the US, all bets are off. It all comes down to American public perception.
That's the one way to change anything, changing perception and understanding here, leading to a change of policy here. As long as the United States supports Israel, nothing's going to happen. The U.S. government will support it as long as the U.S. population tolerates it.
It's now my great pleasure to introduce our moderator tonight. He's a journalist and historian, the head of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, based here in the Valley in Northampton, and the author and editor of over 30 books, including Letters to Palestine, Writers Respond to War and Occupation. Please welcome the amazing Vijay Prashad.
Good evening. Good evening. I'm so glad to be here this evening with you. Before we talk about our event, I'd like to say a few words about the situation in Palestine. For six decades, the people of Palestine have been denied rights of statehood and rights of citizenship. They have been reduced by the cruelty of history to being refugees and an occupied people. The promise of a two-state solution is now largely eviscerated. Settlements in the West Bank, the attrition of East Jerusalem, and the incarceration of Gaza, which is being bombed today, have made any Palestinian state on these territories impossible. Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu has talked about the full-scale annexation of the West Bank. That's the contempt shown by the Israeli state toward the two-state solution. The Israeli state wants a three-state solution to expel Palestinians to the three states of Jordan, Lebanon, and Egypt. This is intolerable. A one-state solution, the position with the most possibility, is rejected by the Israeli state and large sections of Israeli society on the basis that it would no longer permit the existence of a Jewish state. Palestinians would be a near majority, and such democracy would be unacceptable in an ethno-nationalist state. So what Israel is saying is that it is content with being an apartheid state, the annexation of 5 million Palestinians in the occupied territory, who will become second-class citizens inside Greater Israel. That is apartheid, as a United Nations report noted 2 years ago. It is a situation we are confronted with. It is a situation encouraged by the United States government, the government of the land on which we will meet this evening. And yet, even with U.S. complicity in an apartheid situation, no discussion is permitted. If you offer anything less than the annexationist logic of the Israeli state, your speech is disallowed. This event almost did not happen. We, the panelists, were charged in a malicious lawsuit with having, as they said, a publicly known reputation for being anti-Semitic and or supporting known anti-Semites. What is the evidence for this dangerous claim, which maligns our reputations? Thanks to Jewish Voice for Peace and Rachel Weber, we began a slight journey away from such maliciousness. This kind of maliciousness is faced every day by U.S. Representatives Ilham Omar and Rashida Tlaib. It is what is faced daily by Roger Waters, by Dave Zirin, by Mark Lamont Hill, by Linda Sarsour, and to a much less degree by me. It is what we come here to denounce. We are not backing down. We are not backing down. No way. Not when the stakes are so high for the Palestinian people, who should be the focus of this discussion. This conversation should not be about free speech. This discussion should be about the existence of an apartheid situation in West Asia. It should be about the demise of the two-state solution and the emergence of the apartheid state. That should be the focus of the conversation. But it is not. It is about silence. It is about fear. But we are not backing down. We will not be silenced. We will speak of Palestine and amplify the Palestinian voices that seek an exit from apartheid.
Following moderator Vijay Prashad's remarks was a special recorded message from Angela Davis, who was unable to be in attendance.
Good evening, everyone. I am sorry that I'm unable to participate in person in this panel on Palestine and free speech. Therefore, in this virtual format, I want to welcome all of you to this extraordinary event. Despite efforts to cancel it, this panel is still happening. Roger Waters is here. Hello, Roger, and thank you for always standing up for Palestine. Linda Sarsour is participating. Hi, Linda. We stood together in Birmingham, and a few days ago, we were both in Washington participating in an action in defense of Ilhan Omar. Thank you for your invaluable work. And thank you, Sue, and all the organizers for allowing the people in this audience this evening to share a historic moment. It is not coincidental that this event has become the subject of a lawsuit, that Ilhan Omar has received a spate of death threats, that Mark Lamont Hill was fired by CNN, that I myself had a human rights award rescinded, that Michelle Alexander has come under attack for her New York Times column on Palestine. We are experiencing a new historical conjuncture in social justice organizing. The demand for human rights and justice for Palestine no longer remains on the margins of our struggles here in the United States. This demand is moving to the very center of progressive political agendas. One cannot, for example, say that Black Lives Matter without challenging the occupation of Palestine and the policies and practices of the State of Israel. The political consensus that calls for support of Israel at all costs is breaking up. Black people, Latinx people, Asian Americans, progressive Jewish people are joining their Palestinian and Muslim sisters and brothers in demanding justice for Palestine. Boycott, divestment, sanctions. This strategy, this non-violent strategy, which was used during the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, during the anti-apartheid movement, is gaining more and more support every day. And this is why repressive efforts have correspondingly increased. We contest the conflation of legitimate, impassioned critique of Israel with anti-Semitism, and the fabrication of a notion that when the left calls for justice for Palestine, when the left supports BDS, then it has become the anti-Semitic left. This indicates a failure to take anti-Semitism seriously, and it reveals the manipulation of charges of anti-Semitism in a way that recalls the McCarthy era and its manipulation of charges of being communist or communist sympathizers or friends of communist sympathizers. If we want to effectively challenge anti-Semitism, we will recognize the deep interconnections and intersections of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. I know all this and much, much more will be discussed this evening. So welcome to an evening of free speech, edifying speech, critical speech, impassioned speech.
We're going to start with Dave Zirin. Dave Zirin is the sports editor of The Nation. He has a podcast and blog called Edge of Sports. He is the author of 10 books and was nominated for an NAACP Image Award for his book, The John Carlos Story, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. Dave. I've got to put this on.
Got you. Give it up for Vijay Prashad, everybody. My goodness. So I get to go first, the person you haven't heard of. Very exciting. Thank you, Mom. But before I start, there are three things I want to say, just to clear the palate, if you will. Because hearing about everything that's been happening here, I'm ready to burst. Okay, one, there is nothing anti-Semitic about criticizing the actions of the Israeli state, and it is absurd that I even have to say that. Two, there is nothing anti-Semitic about this panel or the people on this panel, and it is damn slander to say otherwise. And in fact, the people up here have been on the front lines of fighting anti-Semitism, especially the most dire threat to me and my fellow Jews, the resurgent white nationalism of the Trump era. Yeah. Yeah. And again, as a Jew, and you may hear me say that a lot in these remarks, but as a Jew, as someone whose family was stamped by the Holocaust, I will be damned if I'll be called anti-Semitic, especially by a coalition that includes Christian Zionists of the Mike Pence variety, people who love Israel but hate Jews and think me and my children are going to hell come the rapture. And we will not be silenced. The efforts to crush this event in the courts has failed. And honestly, trying to silence a public event whose message is we will not be silenced makes me wonder if these groups are allergic to irony. Now, so let's get started. I have to say that my old, very frustrated piano teacher would be thrilled that I was doing a gig with Roger Waters. I just have to say that. But I actually want to start by quoting the Palestinian poet Remy Kanazi, who said, "To be Palestinian in the United States is to face erasure, it's to face marginalization, it's to face attacks and smears, and to be put on blacklists. And that's an important point because it means that those of us who aren't Palestinian have a moral duty to speak out even when it's difficult. Especially for Jews like myself, because the crimes against Palestinians are so often said to be done in our names. Now, it's not easy, as the events here in the last week show only too clearly. And as for me, there have been campaigns to take my job at The Nation, and all because I write about Palestinian athletes and the toll that the occupation takes on their ability to do something as simple as play some sports. And I also criticize athletes who travel to Israel and pose holding guns with the IDF. And I think that's worthy of criticism. And for that, they want my job. But I also want to say that what I've had to endure is so minor compared to the people on this panel, because they are slandered as anti-Semitic, while I'm at least normally just dismissed as a self-hating Jew. Now, let's break down that phrase. I think the great philosopher Larry David said it well, where he said, "Hating myself, sure, but it has nothing to do with being Jewish." But seriously, how is it to hate oneself to oppose military occupation? How is it to hate oneself to stand with those who need solidarity for their survival? And do you know what actual self-hatred would look like? It would look like us becoming what we as a people once opposed, to mimic our oppressors from decades past. That is true self-hatred. You know what self-hatred looks like? Self-hatred would look like us rejecting our history of standing with the dispossessed in order to stand with a state built on stolen land. A country whose prime minister wants to name an illegal settlement after Donald Trump. In fact, if you want to talk about anti-Semitism is when people assume that just because you're Jewish, you must walk in lockstep with the state of Israel. What is anti-Semitic is then the assumption that all Jews support violence and colonization. What is anti-Semitic always is letting bigoted politicians like Donald Trump weaponize our faith and act like they speak for the Jewish people as if they give one damn about our community while they embolden the very forces of white nationalism shooting us in our places of worship. No. No more. No more. No more. My Judaism walks with Representative Ilhan Omar. My Judaism does not walk with Benjamin Netanyahu. My Judaism speaks to the best traditions of a 5,000-year history of radical resistance, a tradition that the Israeli state has long sought to destroy from the collective memory of our people. And that is a self-hatred I will never understand and never abide. But what I found is that the attacks against me and my dissenting Jewish sisters and brothers have gotten more right-wing, more rabid, more frankly unhinged. And it's for a very simple reason. They are enraged because a new generation of Jews are not willing to be silent when it comes to Israel. And that scares them. For years, liberal Jews have been in what we used to call the Pep Squad. Have you ever heard of the Pep Squad? It means progressive except for Palestine. Yet now many more people are describing themselves as Jewish anti-Zionists, or Jazz. So they are leaving the Pep Squad and joining the Jazz Band. My children are half Jewish, we call them Jazz Fusion. Now, we now have growing groups like If Not Now, Jewish Voice for Peace, the students who are protesting birthright. There's even a Jewish pro wrestler named, and I kid you not, David Starr, who talks on Twitter about ending the Israeli occupation. Now, look up David Starr. Now, fewer and fewer of us are willing to be silent, and that should scare those who depend on our privilege, our fear, and our blind loyalty. So now we have this bizarre coalition of Christian Zionists, AIPAC, arms manufacturers, who are trying to intimidate us dissenters in the Jewish community. And it's important to recognize that what unites them, what unites these disparate forces, is that they see Palestinian life as less than human. Whether in Gaza and the West Bank or the refugee camps in Syria, they do not see Palestinians as worth living. That's what unites them. And as Israel chooses more and more to block with far-right actual anti-Semitic governments in Eastern Europe and Brazil, it becomes critical to integrate the fight for Palestine in the larger project of defeating the right, protecting the future of the planet, rebuilding the labor movement, and sustaining struggles against all forms of oppression. And I want to end with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., for one reason, because it's always good to end with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. But I was teaching Dr. King in a sports history class and about his alliance with Muhammad Ali. I was teaching this at Montgomery College in suburban D.C., and I was reading his speech, Beyond Vietnam, and I felt like it was talking directly to this young generation of Jews. Dr. King wrote, "A time comes when silence is betrayal. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony, but we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us. If it is, let us trace its movement and pray that our inner being may be sensitive to its guidance, for we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around us." Thank you very much.
You have been listening to part one of the recorded May 4th, 2019 forum at UMass Amherst called Not Backing Down. Next week, we continue our coverage of the forum featuring Linda Sarsour, Roger Waters, and Mark Lamont Hill. Before we wrap it up today, I want to read a piece written by Palestinian activist and author Nada Elia, who wrote the following in Mondo Weiss concerning our congressional representative, Ayanna Pressley. Nada Elia writes, "It was easy to lash out on social media and express our disappointment, frustration, and anger at political events and developments. In the wake of the horrendous tally overwhelming in favor of H.R. 246, the resolution condemning BDS, I myself posted an outrage commentary. Ayanna Pressley voted against BDS. Shame. I wrote that on my Facebook page, singling her out as a progressive who nevertheless could not cast the right vote on what should have been an absolutely obvious matter. My outrage was based on the assumption that Pressley, hailed as a member of the squad, that is, the rookie of women of color team pushing the Democratic Party away from its accommodationist neoliberal stance, would be a progressive on Palestine rather than one more Zionist progressive, except for Palestine. I confess, I had never heard of Pressley until she ran for Congress. Since then, I learned there were differences on the question of Palestine within the squad, with Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, clearly the more knowledgeable of the four, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez having expressed the need to learn more about the issue. I was blissfully ignorant of Pressley's stance. Yet it is safe to say that most activists around the country simply expected a closing of the squad's ranks when it came to the resolution condemning the Palestinian people's choice of a time-honored strategy to hold their oppressor accountable. Pressley's vote, then, came as a major surprise to most, and she was called out by progressive individuals as well as many organizations. Her response, namely that she voted to condemn BDS as an expression of solidarity with Jewish families, added insult to injury, as it revealed an utter disregard for the Palestinian people's families too, whose ethnic cleansing was ongoing as she voted, as well as many Jews, individuals, and families who fully support BDS. As I discussed what still felt like a betrayal with friends in Massachusetts, however, a different image of Presley began to emerge as longtime activists for Palestinian rights in Boston said they were not surprised by Presley's condemnation of BDS, which they viewed as consistent with her longstanding stance favoring Zionism. I looked up her congressional candidate website, where she discusses her policy positions, and was disappointed to read uncritical platitudes and normalizing talk. There Presley writes, and I quote, "I steadfastly support a two-state solution that will safeguard Israel's future as a Jewish and democratic state and establish a sovereign and independent Palestine. We must avoid efforts to unilaterally blame and deny legitimacy to either side and should instead work towards building a just solution that recognizes the trauma suffered by both populations." Unquote. Such language is possibly worse than a vote condemning BDS, as it discusses the trauma suffered by both populations as if these populations were somewhat equal, similar in their aspirations, rather than oppressor and oppressed, colonized and colonizer, occupier and occupied. Simply, one cannot speak of the pain on both sides of Israel's war on the Palestinian people without being a normalizer of violent settler colonialism that hinges on racism. It is tantamount to Trump's claim that there are fine people on both sides of rallies promoting white supremacy and the protest against those displays of hatred. Presley's statement continues, quote, "My approach to foreign policy is grounded in the same values that inform my domestic priorities, empathy, exclusiveness, and a belief that the solutions to our most important challenges should be informed by the people most impacted. The people closest to the pain should be closest to the power, driving and informing the policy making." Unquote. Apparently, no one told her that the people closest to the pain in this context are the Palestinian people. And the Palestinian people have chosen BDS, which she voted to condemn, thus satisfying a top AIPAC priority. Presley's statement is standard, widely available Zionist drivel. And in typical Zionist lingo, she blames BDS rather than Israeli apartheid for the disruption of meaningful engagement and dialogue. Quote, "I do not support BDS as a means to achieve a two-state solution because I believe it does not acknowledge the efforts of those on the ground who are deeply committed to bringing peaceful coexistence to the region and pushes Israelis and Palestinians further away from the meaningful engagement and dialogue needed to emphasize with each other's struggle and acknowledge each other's humanity." Unquote. Yet even as many were expressing their outrage at Presley's vote, Congresswoman Rashid Tlaib herself, who had sponsored a resolution supporting the right to boycott, wrote in Facebook Exchange that we should not give up on Presley. "This is a missed opportunity," Tlaib wrote, in response to a post critical of Presley. "Don't dismiss those who voted to target this form of speech that criticizes Israel. Our movement for equality, freedom, and upholding human rights for Palestinians is growing outside the halls of Congress. We gain more respect that way rather than making them fear us, like those who want to continue oppressing Palestinians and black Israelis. This is the largest incoming class since Watergate, and many don't know what occupation even means. We live it, but so many of my colleagues haven't been engaged enough. Unquote. Tlaib continued in defense of Presley, saying, I have heard Representative Ayanna Pressley quote the words of Angela Davis, speak out the pain of othering so powerfully. Don't give up because of one vote. My grandmother and all those living under occupation and racist policies deserve us to take this as a challenge. Request meetings. Follow up in a thoughtful way. Write op-eds. Educate and mobilize. This is the beginning of a new era. I have been there, and don't think that I don't know how much it hurts, but we can't give up so easily on people anymore. This is a new class of members. This is a new opportunity. Palestine is not the only issue, but it is certainly emblematic, which is why so many of us argue that one cannot genuinely be progressive except for Palestine. If we are to give Presley the benefit of the doubt and assume that she fell back on the Zionist lines of default because she did not know better, then we should educate her, share with her words of Angela Davis, whom she quotes, but also Desmond Tutu and Mark Lamont Hill and Blacks for Palestine and Black Lives Matter on Palestine. If then she cannot understand who is inflicting the pain and who is suffering it, and if she still refuses to support the leadership of the most impacted, then we have no choice but to write her off. But let us not do so before we try and try again. We've had to do that with just about every politician so far, and with a handful of exceptions of those rare individuals who grasp it without our outreach. It's not fair, but then again, if the world were fair, we would not be fighting this battle. That was a commentary written by Palestinian activist and author Nada Elia in Mondawise. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.